Stella Barone McGillivray. Chapter 31. It's mayhem. My mother screams. My dad throws me back into Bethany's pen. The policemen have their weapons out. They're shouting directives into the radio and out at the intruder, both. It's impossible to see anything beyond the light, it's so bright. The policemen brave the unseen and get sucked into the place where I can't tell what's going on. The noises are too indistinct to make out. My knee throbs where I landed on it. My head spins with the thought that I am exactly back where I was before. Something Genevieve once said comes to mind unbidden. I swear he's watching us, because he only ever seems to come when we're asleep. He saw us come in. He'll kill us all. For the second time in my life, or perhaps just this once in my real life, I tug at the trap door. The musty basement smell invades my nostrils. I tell my dad to get Mom. He sees what I see and crawls out of the pen on all fours. The wait is interminable. I watch him go. I see him when he reaches the doors and my mother, but while I'm busying myself at the ladder, I look away long enough to lose them, and when I look up again, they're both gone. My mind reels. What have I even got to defend myself with? I ache to recall the events of that last day in the house. Surely there's something there, a carving knife or a fireplace poker that I can use to kill a killer. I'm one half beneath the ground, whisper-hissing Bethany and Genevieve's names. I peer into the utter darkness and envision someone reaching up and taking me by an ankle from below when my dad returns. I'm still on high alert, but he's walking a little too casually to be in a panic. "It's okay," he says, and pulls me up out of the hole one-handed. "What's okay?" It turns out they were just a couple of hunters out spotlighting. Hunters. Killers by definition, but not of humankind. Turns out what they're doing is illegal even during hunting season. These guys are busted. "But we're good to go," my dad says. The spotlight is off. I can see the four-wheelers they were using to get around on. That's the whining sound I heard earlier. "How long have they been out here?" I ask my dad. And then one of the hunters is carted directly past the open door in handcuffs, and I yell it. "How long have you been out here?" My dad shushes me, again, like a child. He says, "They've been here a couple of days." "And did they see?" "They didn't run into any missing girls." My heart sinks. How could they not? What is wrong with me? I did the research, followed the clues, and everyone led me to this place that is now impossibly empty. I really must be crazy. My dad leads my mother and me away by flashlight. The ground is uneven. It feels like sawdust under my feet, but when I look, I see that this dust is bright orange. It isn't a lot, but it's there. I'm not making this up. I am not crazy. I'm almost too thrilled, too terrified to believe I might actually be crunching over a pile of forgotten Cheez-Its. Chapter 32. So what started out as a kidnapping investigation ends up with the police taking two idiot hunters into custody. They're drunk, besides, and they've totally detracted from the real purpose of coming into the woods tonight. The cops didn't even check the rest of the facility. We're told to go, and no, it isn't a suggestion. My parents and I talk on the way home, which is new for us, at least on the subject of my dreams. I tell them about my discovery with the Cheez-It dust. I tell them how I knew the place, where each of the girls was staying, where I stayed. "The trap door," I say. "How would I have known about the trap door?" I throw caution to the wind and tell them I was the one sighted by the hunter one late night. I do not tell them I died. My mother tries justifying it all. "You must have gone there as a child, on a field trip or something." My dad is holding her hand, gently rubbing the scared, tired knuckles. I've ruined camping for her forever. "You simply tucked the memory away in your subconscious," she says, "only to have it resurface in a very vivid dream." She looks to my dad for support. His confirming nod is another bullet in my gut. She knows where I've been on field trips. She knows every place I go. "And what about the Cheez-It dust?" I ask. "Stella," Mom says. Her ensuing laugh comes out slightly delirious. "Do you hear yourself? Cheez-It dust?" But isn't it just possible that Mr. Hammond heard noises outside? Those four-wheelers aren't quiet. They might have spooked him, made him think someone was coming for him. He'd have time to cover his tracks and get out of there before we came. No, my mother cuts me off. No, it isn't possible. And you know that. She turns around in her seat. Why are you doing this to us? It's gone on long enough. And honestly, Stella, I don't understand what you're getting so worked up about. They're East Valley girls. I'm an East Valley girl, I want to shout. She spins back around in her seat. Please just let it go. But I can't. And it isn't just the loss, it's the guilt, too. East Valley girls, she says. No longer one of them, I can't pretend anymore that I don't have it all. I am privileged, no question. When you're from a certain neck of the woods and someone turns to drugs or prostitution or ends up in juvie or in prison, nobody ever asks why. They just assume that's the way it is. But these girls don't belong there. I didn't belong there. It would be a gigantic betrayal to Teresa if I turned my back on the missing now. And what's worse is I'd be turning my back on the best part of myself. I was better over there. I spend a few seconds mulling that over. Is it true? Even if it's not, maybe Jack's right and I am the only version of me. I'm better for having known the over there. The conversation dies. We talk of nothing for the next hour or so. I pretend to sleep in the back, and when we pull into our driveway, I get out of the car before the garage has even come up. I'm out and climbing the front steps. Stella, my mother calls after me, aren't you hungry at all? I pretend again that I don't hear her and keep walking, but I do hear. I hear my mother say to my dad, I'll call the treatment center tomorrow. Upstairs, I step into a hot shower and let the water run for a good 10 minutes before I even think about soaping up. For the moment, I don't have to look my screwed-up self in the eye, and I relish it. My mother may be right. I don't even know Bethany here. I don't know Genevieve. At its heart, this is all a selfish act on my part. I just wanted my own life back, and that isn't going to happen, not if it wasn't ever real to begin with. I cut the water, dry off, and change into my ugly winter pajamas that are so soft and cozy, I couldn't care less if the editor of the Walter Morgan yearbook came this very minute requesting a photo shoot. I burrow under the covers and turn off the lights. Tomorrow, my mother is calling the treatment center. My bedroom door opens and light from the hallway spills over my sorry form. I flip around in bed, turning my back to it, but my mother takes a seat on the mattress anyway. It's been a long night, she says. She picks at my wet hair, pulling tendril after tendril out from under my comforter, until it's all draped across my pillow. It isn't that I don't believe you. It's all right, I say. You win. She falters for only a second. I never wanted to win. And then she smooths the hair from scalp to tip, one section after another. It reminds me so poignantly of the way my mother used to do it back home in the East Valley. I bite the blanket and cry, willing the memory away already. It isn't fair. I need the mother who gets me right now. I want to go home. My mother says, when I was your age, I envisioned my future life much differently than this. I thought I would have half a dozen kids, be PTA president and soccer mom. And then, when I found out I couldn't get pregnant, I sort of had to rethink things. It's hard, starting over like that. She would hum to me while she played with the hair, my birth mother would, and occasionally sing, too. I didn't get to hear her sing a whole lot. Once I got too old to be sleeping beneath the bar at the club, I didn't ever go over to watch her. I had to satisfy myself with the occasional practice session at the apartment when she'd be learning something new for work. But then we got you, my mother, the other one, says. And you were such a blessing. From the very moment I laid eyes on you, I knew. I thought, anyway, that I'd be raising my best friend. She pauses. Her hand lies still on my head. It's not too late for that, is it? I can still hear my mother singing. Whether or not I made her up, she was real to me. I felt it. I feel it still. Stella, my mother says, maybe it's time to rethink a thing or two. Can you go now? I say. When her fingers stiffen on my scalp, I add, because I feel like I have to. I'm tired. My mother kisses my forehead and goes. I stay awake at least another hour trying to recall the exact color of my birth mother's eyes. I can't. Chapter 33. The next day, school has started already by the time I awaken. My parents are both home still. When I join them in the kitchen, they gauge my well-being with identical, nervous, pinched looks that I'm certain will be a part of every one of their clothing ensembles from now until summer. There is one thing, though. My crash seems not to be tearing them apart so much as it's bringing them closer together. Dad pours me juice and Mom puts a plate of eggs in front of me. After the pleasantries, how are you feeling? Did you sleep well? We've notified the school. Want you home relaxing today. I wait for the bomb to drop. Something along the lines of how we'll all take a nice family drive later, ending up, of course, at the frosted glass doors of the treatment center. It's not quite how things go down. My mother says instead, I have some things to do at work, and your dad has class. I look up from my breakfast and nod. Okay, I'll be fine here. Well, she wrings her hands, glancing from me to my father and back again. Clearly, she was just waiting for the right moment to tell me. We've asked Melissa to come and sit with you. I shake my head. Melissa Darby? Please. Please, no. She cares about you, Stella. Don't make me have a babysitter. It's an embarrassment only one step shy of the treatment center. Please, I say, I'm done. I swear I'm done. No more dreams. No more missing girls. My mother draws a breath. She and my dad share another look. Please, I say again. My mother closes her eyes while letting her breath out. You have an appointment with Sue later. I nod. Yes, of course. And you will keep this on you. Surely, so she can track my whereabouts. I take the cell phone I didn't know I had lost. Got it, I say. Thank you. I finish my breakfast, let them kiss and cuddle me, and then, once I'm absolutely certain they're both gone for the day, I dress down and go for a walk. I leave the phone. It's a nice enough morning. I take the hoodie off and let the sun warm me. It was crazy to think I might help recover the missing girls with information I'd stored away from a dream state. I shouldn't have pushed so hard. I guess I just thought that bringing them back might give me a fighting chance at recovering some of what I had lost as well. All taken from me with the cocking of a gun. Because, to be honest, it terrifies me how incomplete my life really is. I invested in nothing. Not here in La Quinta, not in Coachella. I never took chances, didn't know what to believe in or fight for. It didn't ever bother me that my mother was overprotective here. I didn't go out or put myself out there because I had my freedom elsewhere. I had Teresa. I had marimba. They don't even have a marimba group at the private school. Here, I am not my better half. What do people do when they've lived with someone forever and then suddenly lose them? Like a spouse. I've heard stories. Soulmates don't tend to stick around very long once their partner has passed on. Am I doomed to the same outcome? Do I have enough life left in me all by myself? The sun is being noncommittal, poking its head out for seconds at a time before hiding away again. It succumbs finally to the clouds and the sky is overcast for the duration of my journey. I'm entering familiar territory. The palm tree farm and Augustine Casino. Disappearing sidewalks and patches of dirt and nothing. But right now, the nothing is everything to me. Bagduma Park is in my wake when I get the first whiff of fresh conchas. It smells like home. While stepping up to the door of our piece of this one-story complex, I put the hoodie back on. It feels like a day of mourning. I mourn my own death and the deaths of the people I cared most about, the things I once loved. The last time I was here, I was somehow drugged and taken. I feel for the hole in my neck while knocking on my old apartment door. My mother will be asleep still if her routine is the same. Unlikely. She probably doesn't even live here anymore. There isn't any movement inside. I press my hand against the door and call her by her first name, Blanche. Then again, louder. There isn't any response. After Grandma Harriet died, it would just be my mother left here alone. Did she stay? With no roots, no real connection? She could be in a different city by now, a different state, married with kids even, on the other side of the world. Maybe she found her Daniel again and they're taking care of each other, as they should be. I just hope she's happy. McGillivray? The voice startles me. An elderly woman stands down the hallways, one hand on her ample hip, the other on her open door. Barb. It's old Barb, whose paper I once stole. You looking for Blanche McGillivray? She hasn't lived here for a couple years now, but I remember her. Pretty thing. Couldn't ever get her to stop singing. Barb shifts focus and heads back inside. She'll be out at the college, the woman nods. That-a-way. I point where she nods. The college, I say. Barb lifts her eyebrows, gives another nod. Thank you. I walk in the direction I think I know, though I've never gone this route before. Dad always takes the 111 straight from La Quinta into Indio. It's not a short hike, but I make good time up Van Buren in my half-jog, slightly elated state. My mother teaches at the college now? They don't have a school of music, so it must be something else. She'd had to have gone back to school, gotten her degree, went on to some form of higher education. I can't even imagine what. And who cares? My mother did well for herself. For the first time since the glamp out, I'm happy. I can breathe again, happy. When I'm partway down Requa and I can see the three-story building in the distance, I'm picturing Professor McGillivray standing at one of those windows looking out, seeing me. But of course, she's too far involved in her lecturing to notice. That's when I hear the music. It's my mother playing, I know it. And I see her, too, but she's not standing at one of the windows in the college. She's across the street, on the corner, sitting on a little plastic crate, an opened guitar case in front of her. A sudden burst of wind blows her hair wild. Pockets of college students walk swiftly this way and that in front of her, not even bothering to stop and listen. So this is her life without me in it, without Grandma Harriet. No roots, no real connection. It's more than wrong. It's a nightmare. I keep walking toward her. I don't want to anymore. Don't even know that I'm doing it, but somehow my feet get me to where my mother sits, stooping and gray over a song so beautiful it betrays how she's aged. Though even still, she has that quiet grace about her. As I watch, she laughs at someone's passing comment. Whoever it was, they weren't even talking to her. Barb said my mother would be here, as if this was her daily routine now. Is it? She didn't move up, didn't escape the life she loathed. She succumbed to it, possibly from no other choice. This is where she plays. On what other street corner does she live? I ache to be held by her. The music will have to do. When she plays, she is lost in it. She's somewhere else altogether, transported. By dream, perhaps. It seems to me she's doing it on purpose. Her escape is in closing her eyes and feeling the music. When she comes back around 8 or so minutes later and sees me standing there, she nods in a knowing sort of way. She says to me while she plays, "You have that look." I move closer. "What look?" "Like you wish you could be somewhere else?" She smiles the way I remember her smiling before, wistful, but content. "I know it well," she says, and for a moment she stops playing. She studies me carefully. "You seem familiar." If there is a line separating sanity from delusion, I'm standing on it. I take one step closer. Her eyes widen slightly in recognition. There's a trace of panic in them. She knows who I am. She knows I'm her daughter. A second passes and she drops her gaze, quietly composes herself, and keeps on playing. Over the sound of the music, she says, "Never mind. I was wrong." "No," I say, "you weren't." She doesn't look, doesn't respond. Her playing grows louder. "Please don't," I say. "Please look at me." She can't, or she won't. She says again, "I was wrong. I don't know you." "How can you not?" Her playing grows more intense. I can see her breath catching in her throat. She swallows over and over. "You said..." I stop myself. It's just more crazy talk, but I'm so far past the line now, I say it anyway. "You said we were meant to be together." She shakes her head, closes her eyes, and plays. "Chase a dream, and it'll run away." Chapter 34. I don't have to walk home. My dad is at the college teaching, presumably. If I can find him in time, I could catch a ride. Of course, then I'd have to come up with a reason as to why I'm here and not at home resting, and why I've been avoiding their calls. I wonder if he's ever seen my mother on her street corner. Surely he's heard her. It's possible my mother isn't even dreaming here. Something about what Jack said previously rings true in the way she looked at me. Who knows? There are probably yous out there that aren't aware there are other yous out there. In how many existences are we unaware there are other existences, I wonder. I do a lap around the block, still within earshot of my mother singing, trying to make a decision about where to go from here when the wind finally forces me in on the west side of the college. There's a map near the entrance, a listing of professors by floor and room number that I glance at by habit. I already know where to find my dad, but it isn't his name that stands out to me. It's the name Hammond that shines as bright as Mauricio's neons. I'm depressed and hungry. It's now past lunchtime. And what have I got to lose? Not my mother, clearly. Didn't my dad mention something about how the professor's not working anymore? So what's the harm in knocking? I climb the stairs to the second floor, count the offices down the left side of the hall, and find Professor Hammond's door open. I make myself walk this plank-feeling bit of carpeted hallway. My heart pounds, but I enter without knocking and without apology. I'm closed, the professor says, doesn't even look up from his desk. Here sits an old man. Some might call him frail, even. If he were astonished, though, if I surprised him the way I did that night turning up in the house portion of his makeshift prison, and he gave me that look again, I'd be seeing into the eyes of my killer. As it is, he pauses from his work to peer at me. My blood runs cold. I grip the doorframe for balance. I'm on sabbatical, he says. Were you looking for Professor Garibaldi? No, I say. He squints and puts his pencil down. Are you all right? When I was with Jack, we decided on a backstory, a half-true version of a sequence of recent events. I turn the page of that particular script now. I saw you with the missing girls. Genevieve Ortiz, your own daughter, Bethany. The creases in his brows deepen. He comes half out of his chair. Do you have information about my Bethany? No. I take a protective step back. Where did you move them? Move them? He says. What are you? I'm sorry, did you see them somewhere? He comes out from behind the desk. Stop, I say. He does. I scan the hallway right and left. I'm alone here and losing control. I say again, I saw you. You were keeping them in a barn, up the mountain off the 74. I know it was you. What? He clutches his chest as if he's the one being attacked. He's playing a good part, I'll give him that. The barn, I say, and I know I'm babbling, but I can't stop. It's part of a research facility. There's a barn and an underground passageway that leads to a house. I'm shaking a little at this point, shaking and angry because when will I ever stop sounding crazy? I describe it, the high boarded-up windows, the wood slats made of pine and oak, the stone base. I tell him about the stalls, their size and number, the rotating poop floor, the music, and the passageway. And all the while he just stands there listening. He hasn't come any closer. His expression does not change. When I'm through, he responds with the last thing in the world I would have expected. You're right, he says. That is my barn. Mine and my wife's. He falls, more than sits, back into his chair, clearly perplexed. I had the passageway built so as I didn't have to go outside during a storm to feed the cows. When it seemed we might lose our funding, my wife purchased the home and barn both, with her grandfather's inheritance. She couldn't bear to see it go. But I don't understand. How do you know the place? I shake my head, all afog. So it's his wife's name on the title. Makes sense, but I'm losing my grip on the script. Line, please. Oh, he says, you're the tip. The police told me they'd be searching the house. I told them I'd already been there. Granted, I wasn't looking for anything, or anyone. Is that where you saw me? Were you on the property that night? He leans forward, an anguished look on his face. Did you see my Bethany? What is he talking about? I want to scream. What day? I ask. Pardon? I said, what day did you go last week? It was, the man scratches his chin in thought, Thursday. He gives me that look again. Why did you think my daughter was there? I fall into the nearest chair myself. I was shot on a Thursday. His anguish turns to hope as he studies me. The man is waiting for an answer to a question he already knows the answer to. He must be totally sick. And he doesn't stop talking. I don't know why I went, to feel closer to her, I suppose. It's where we were the best version of ourselves. It's where we were a family. I hadn't been back since before my wife passed, and now, with Bethany gone too, I was feeling sentimental, I guess. I can assure you the place was empty. Far too empty. I can't help it. I start to cry. How can he lie so easily? He's a killer. He's psychotic. He absolutely was there last Thursday and only doesn't remember pulling the trigger because I wasn't there. Not in this state. Not the girl from La Quinta. He wouldn't remember the killing of Stella McGillivray, but I do. Was one of the girls a friend of yours? He asks. I nod. Well, thank you for the help. Heaven knows we can use it. He reaches across the desk. I flinch away from his touch. I'm sorry if I've upset you. This is rich. He is comforting me. My head hurts. There was no one in the barn last night, and Mr. Hammond certainly doesn't act like a killer. My dad, the police chief, they're both so certain he isn't. Then what did I see exactly in my other state? Am I chasing dreams here, too? Is that all this is? Nothing real, nothing true? Nothing like two parallel universes actually interacting with one another. It was simply, purely, just a dream. No. Despite it all, I can't believe that. He's playing it cool. He moved them somewhere. He was probably responsible for his own wife's death as well. Bethany was only covering for him. I just can't make sense of it. It's all so wrong. He asks, Can I call someone for you? I jump up and leave his office. I don't stop running until I've cleared the boundary between East Valley and West, between truth and fiction. While I run, my mother's playing rings in my head. It's as if she's calling me home.